Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Sports Community Radio with your hosts, Joe Novella and Steve Palla. Steve, welcome to the show. How are you, mate?
Oh, Joe, it's been a big week in my family. A couple of birthdays this week. I'm exhausted already.
And a big week in mine because it was my birthday too. I've reached a ripe old age of 21 now.
Yeah, I might have forgotten that, and you're probably double that, Joe, but you've also moved house on that week, so it's been a big week for both of us.
Big week for both of us. Now, mate, we've got an absolute monster of a show today. We've got Ben Bainbridge, who's the Executive Officer Recreation from Yarra Rangers Council, talking to us about working with the council on major works. We've also got one of our very popular top nine segments, and the top nine today is what, my friend?
The top nine is, why should a club go to all the effort of attracting local or their local media coverage?
Okay, but before we get into all of that, like always, every week, we talk to you all about the latest and greatest grants that have become available to grassroots sports clubs. So, Steve, kick us off.
Yeah, Joe, this week I just want to touch on four grants from around the country, a couple of them from Victoria, one from New South Wales, and one from South Australia. At the moment on the Sports Community website, which is www.sportscommunity.com.au, there's about 55 different grants of different types from that clubs from around the country can apply for, from at a federal level, at a state level, territory level, and from a corporate level. But the four that I just wanted to touch on today, the first two from Victoria. First of all, from football and netball clubs are just kicking off their season. And so the Country Football Netball Grant Program, which is only open, unfortunately, to rural, regional and out-of-metro clubs, but they can apply for up to $100,000, Joe. So it's a serious
yeah, that is big.
Yeah, serious grant program. And so it's for big ticket items particularly, so upgrading your facilities, your grounds, your change rooms, your lighting. So this one's open for until the 30th of May. So there's a fair bit of time for clubs to get in and apply for these grants, but be wary of this one because there's going to be a lot of preparation work required to do the grant. There's going to be a lot of quotes that you're going to need, potentially plans that you're going to need, potentially studies. So if you're a football netball club in rural regional Victoria and you want to improve your facilities, brilliant one. A sport at the end of their season, Cricket Victoria is offering for the next till the 30th of March the opportunity for clubs and associations and regions to apply for funding out of their strategic grants fund. Now, what that is, Joe, is it's a club can do anything that's consistent with Cricket Victoria's strategic objectives. So that's very, very broad and a really good opportunity for clubs to tailor up a grant proposal and send that through to Cricket Victoria. Now obviously participation and facilities are the two major things that Cricket Victoria is looking for. That one closes at the end of the month at the 30th of March. Now, participation and facilities is very, very, very common theme throughout the grants. And one of the major grant programs of the New South Wales State Government is the Participation and Facility Program, Joe, which is really those two areas combined. This grant program's open until the 2nd of April. And it applies. There's two types of grants that clubs can apply for. New South Wales clubs can apply for, and we talk about grants from all around Australia, Joe, because our listeners are from all around Australia, and some international actually. But facility grant applications, clubs can apply for up to $25,000. So we're not necessarily looking at the major facility improvements, more your minor extensions and your minor improvements there. And the second part of this program is participation programs. So clubs can apply for up to $10,000 to undertake participation programs, whether it is to link in with schools, link into different minority groups that may not be participating in your sport, which is becoming more and more important, or it's just a general increase the marketing and participation of your club. So if your club's in New South Wales and looking to increase participation, this is a fantastic grant for you, closing on the 2nd of April. South Australia has exactly the same grant program, Joe. They call it the Active Club Program. It's slightly less available, $20,000 is up to $20,000 is available for facilities requests. So again, the minor facility improvements, which is not so minor when you're talking $20,000. But your participation programs and your equipment requests, you can apply for up to $5,000 worth of grants. Now that one closes on April the 14th, Joe, but if you're a club that's thinking of wanting to get money through grants for any reason, I was having a look at the website this morning and there's as I said, there's 53 grants and there's really nothing that a club can want money for that really there isn't a grant open for somewhere around the country.
So make sure you check the website www.sportscommunity.com.au for the latest and greatest in grant information. Also, if you want to give us your feedback on anything that we have discussed during the show and the podcast, join the show at sportscommunity.com.au is the email to get us at, and give us your feedback, and we will certainly take that on board. And if there's something that you want to discuss, we'll raise that during the show.
Yeah, we've had a couple of emails through, Joe, come through to me during the week, which we'll tackle next week, which will some very, very interesting ones about fundraising particularly, which I look forward to sharing on next week's show, Joe.
Beautiful. You're listening to Sports Community Radio with your hosts, Steve Pellis and Joe Novella, another Sports Community digital production, courtesy of www.sportscommunity.com.au. All right, you're with RPPFM with Steve Pellis and Joe Novella here on Sports Community Radio. Today we have Ben Bainbridge, who is the Executive Officer at Recreation at Yarra Rangers Council. Welcome to the program, Ben.
Thanks, Joe. Thanks, Steve.
No worries, mate. Thank you very much for giving us your time. Today we're really excited to talk to you about the process that you went through in really securing $1.8 million worth of funding that made the Olinda Sports Pavilion project possible. Do you want to just give us just a little bit of background to the Olinda area and why there was a need for such a big pavilion to go into that area? And then we'll start to talk about the process and how you actually got all that money together.
Yeah, no problem. Look, the Olinda community is a fantastic community up in the hills area of Yarra Ranges. Now, Yarra Ranges is quite a diverse place. They've got a significant bushland area, which is national park and state forest. We've got a big agricultural farming area, as well as the Yarra Valley wine district. But we've also got an urban area. So we're known as an interface peri-urban council, which is an interesting place to work, where Olinda is up in our hills area in pretty significant bushland area, but we've got a lovely reserve right at the top of the hill up at Mount Dandenong there. Yeah. And what's inherent in respect to the facilities that we have in our ranges is that over the time it's really been built by volunteer labour and kind of been built in a real piecemeal way. I guess that's fantastic up to a point where you kind of have extension after extension after extension on a building. But after 30 or 40 years of extensions and the building being really at the end of its life, what people expect now and what the community expect is something a lot more contemporary that really meets the community needs. And we also, more recently in the last 5 years, we've had netball competition be introduced into the Yarra Valley.
Yep.
But we had a new user as well. So it was really important that we kind of took a step where we worked with community and formed a reserve development group. And we actually undertook a master plan process to understand what the priorities are for that whole community and the reserves out there. And one of those priority projects was to do a business case and look at a new pavilion for Olinda because of the age and condition of the existing facility and that it just didn't meet community need. So that's kind of how the project came about.
So the start of the project was actually driven by council identifying a need rather than a club or a group of clubs in this case, because Olinda Pavilion's used by five different clubs, is it? Five or six different clubs?
So we've got a cricket club, a netball club, a football club, there, but we've also got a number of community groups there as well, and we've got OzKick. So it's a real, you can imagine it to be kind of a small community kind of feel where Alinda Reserve is seen as the social heartbeat and hub of that community up there. So on a weekend, you get everyone from the community there and the whole range of different activities there. It's also the Central Reserve with the playground. But actually, no, the master plan came about from the community more than council.
Okay,
community formed a group called the Hilltop Association,
yep.
A really active professional group, and they came together with all the clubs and groups and community interested community members came together, and they wanted to do something better for their community. And what they did, and what the first step they did, was engage with their council's recreation area,
yep.
And the council's recreation area is often the responsible for kind of doing master plans for reserves, so more the strategic aspect of a developing a reserve, which is really a requirement from us, from a council point of view, for us to be able to invest in any development on a reserve. So if we often required to really have a strategic framework for how we invest our money. So if there's justification and there's real agreement with the community and council about how we want to improve the facilities, and we can do that through a master plan process, then once we've got to that point, it really makes the individual projects like a new pavilion really quite clear, and it's able that we're able, council through our investment, can partner community through their investment, but also allow us to lever other funding agencies like state government or federal government or Bendigo Bank in this instance,
yep.
To come together to kind of create a new facility.
Wow. Well, let's go right back to the start of the process. When did the community, I mean, we're now in March 2014, and yeah. So you're just partway through the build now. So when did the community actually come together to start to talk about this project? How many years ago was that, do you think?
Yeah, well, it was before my time here that they started having a conversation. I came on when they started the master plan process in 2009.
Yeah.
So it would have been a year before then that we actually started the master plan process. After that master plan was done, if we take the pavilion itself, that's been a process over the last 3 years that we've been working on to get to this stage of now constructing the pavilion.
And the reality has been that's actually pretty quick for the process end to end, isn't it? I mean, one of the things that when we're talking to clubs is they make the decision that they want to do a major extension or major redevelopment of their facilities or playing arena, and they get frustrated quite a lot that it's they don't realise it's going to take a number of years, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years. But that's the reality of these projects of these magnitude, isn't it?
It is. Look, if it's a lighting project, it probably takes a couple of years to get through. If you're talking about a new pavilion, it can take 5 years to get that development. But there's a lot involved in that process. Like if we break it up, we're talking about a master plan that sets the scene for that whole reserve. You've got to go through a council process, and that can take up 6 to 18 months run through that formal process.
Can you just explain, Joe's got a question, he's dragged his eyes off the telly, but
yep.
Can you just explain to the listeners what a master plan is and the process that is normally gone through? Oh, I've just stolen Joe's question. but the process that would normally go through from a master plan and what the end result is and why it's important for clubs to understand that process.
Yeah, okay. Well, the objective of a master plan is to have a set of directions on how you will improve that reserve to meet the community demand. And so what steps are involved in a master plan is that you often do a review of the participation demands. You probably look at some national, state and regional participation statistics.
Yep.
We have a fairly good profile of our health profile as well. So I guess the reason why we really want to have developed our reserves is to create healthy and active places and environments for people to be fit and healthy. We've got an objective in our ranges, which wouldn't be dissimilar to a lot of other councils, around trying to reduce our physical activity levels and increase our physical activity levels and decrease our obesity levels, which are far too high. And so that's really our objective, and that's really community's objective as well. A lot of sports clubs' objectives is about improving their facilities for their membership to meet their needs. Like we had a group here that wasn't even catered for netball.
Yes.
We're going to create some new netball change facilities. We can only do that through a process where we kind of have a look at the statistics, the demands. We have good engagement with community and those key stakeholders, those sports clubs and other interest groups that are on site, to understand all their needs and aspirations. And then we certainly do a review into the site, because there's a lot of constraints that need to be understood, but also it's important to understand where the opportunities lie as well. Like there might be a vacant bit of land, but with some great big trees that can offer shade, that we might actually develop, which is a really important design consideration in respect to location of a playground, for example. Like where this reserve may not have had a playground, but in the way that we consulted, the surveying that we did, and in our workshops with community and our sports club meetings, is that often, having some area for play is really important to that community. So that's kind of the process that we run. We have a look at the site, we look at the opportunities and the constraints on the site, engage with community, we look at the statistics, and we come up with a set of kind of principles around what we want to achieve on that reserve, and then we look at, well, this is how we can achieve it. And that's really where the master plan gets to. It establishes really a vision of what we want to create, and it gets down to the detail around what improvements we'd like to make to achieve those broad objectives that I spoke of before.
Ben, Joe here. We talk about strategic use of the fields and the resources, and strategic is one of these words that often confuses a lot of the people out there in terms of what it actually means. How much is it incumbent upon the people that come to you, so in this case the community, to have the strategic thinking sorted out and the data and the facts to back that up? Or does a lot of the fact-finding fall to the council once the community has come to you with a proposition, or is it a mixture of both?
It certainly helps when the community can articulate what issues that they are having. I wouldn't say that they necessarily need all the data, because that's something that council has expertise in. We have the expertise in-house to help guide and navigate through a planning process. All this is to bring together everybody's thoughts and ideas and some of the issues faced, and around trying to agree on what we really want at the end of the day, which is a place for people to be healthy and active. And so really, that's the framework for what we run through this process with. But once you get into the process, once you have the conversation with council, a council will be able to give this quite clear advice on what role council plays and what community play in respect to delivery of these plans. So let's take the pavilion for an example. We develop essentially a funding proposal that meets the objective, or a business case, or whatever whatever word you want to put around it, that steps through the strategic justification, the participation benefits, the who's involved, looks at kind of the how, the what we want to build, the design and the cost that sit around it, and then the why, the reason why we want to build it, the range of different benefits, but actually articulating, we're actually looking to meet these needs. These needs are actually going to be generate a 5% increase in participation levels. And so essentially, we're able to we need input from community in that, because we need data from the sports clubs around what their memberships are, what profile of their memberships are, and what they'd like to see in the future. Now, they might be saying, well, we want to build our netball up from one team to five teams. Well, we need to know that through the process. Mm. And what that does, by knowing that level of information, identifies where we're going to have pressure points in our existing facilities and where we might need to make improvements, whether it's in the playing fields or whether it's in the buildings in the future. So community can have an idea of what that is at the start of the process and can give us examples around where they are currently having some pressure or giving us an idea around what their aspirations are in the future. And then that allows us to have a discussion around predicting where some of those issues might be in the future. That's kind of what we want at the start of the process. So that's a good conversation to have in committees. Mm. And again, and amongst all the other users that are reserved, they start having that conversation. And once you have a little bit of an idea of what those three or four key pressure points are, or one of those three or four, you know, things that you'd like to see in the future, then that's when you go talk to your council recreation team, who then will take that on board and say, okay, well, that's fantastic. There's a whole range of different steps that we need to do to put it in front of council to get their okay to go onto a reserve master plan or do a pavilion business case or funding proposal. And once we get to that stage, we're into the planning process, and that's where council kind of take over. They might get a consultant to come on board. They might do some in-house. And you go through that engagement process that I spoke of before. And that process will ask a lot of clubs and community groups a whole range of different questions to have a good, solid business case for developing a new pavilion or developing a new playing field. And once you get to that stage and council endorses that and may throw some money at it, that's a really fantastic point of time where community can then fundraise, they can go talk to a great local benefactor that we've got here is Bendigo Bank, and we can also, that's the kind of framework that we've used in Yarra Rangers anyway, around we've basically through that process gathered all the information that's required for any funding program, whether it's through state or federal government, and actually applied through that process. So, and that really puts us in a fantastic position, because within a 12-month time frame of really going through that planning framework, we can really focus on receiving money where we can get to a position of hopefully building the project, which is where everyone really wants to at the end of the day.
Ben, one of the challenges of the local grassroots sports out there is that especially the heavy participation sports like soccer and AFL and these kind of sports, they tend to have, when they go to councils, they tend to have a vision for their own sport. It sounds to me like one of the real strengths of the proposal for the Alinda ground was that it was that it got buy-in from multi-sport. So I know you can only speak on behalf of Yarra Rangers, but if I'm a club president or a club committee out there that's in an area that has a number of different sports and you do see a need, what's your advice to them on approaching council? Because a lot of these folks, and I've worked with them, they seem to think that there's a lot of smoke and mirrors happening behind council walls, whereas when you get to talk to someone like yourself, you realise that your real motivation is to try and do the best for the whole community. So what do you advise these clubs out there that do have these challenges in areas where there's a lot of different sports competing for the same resource? How do you advise them to proceed in that case?
Okay, yeah, it's a good question, because you can take it even further. You've got different peak sporting bodies with different objectives as well, and they often come in conflict, where council needs to make a view based on our particular objective is around community health and well-being, which isn't necessarily around sports participation supporting the success of a sport club. Of course, we support the success, but it's probably a secondary kind of consideration from our point of view. We just want to make sure people are healthy and active, and we're having that activity happen out there. So, look, my advice is that you need to engage with your reserve committee. The stronger the groups that actually get runs on the board that actually develop these facilities, they are the ones that they're the ones that sorry guys. They're the ones that often are the ones that they talk to each other, they work together, and they have a real agreed way of how they want to improve it. Once you get to that point, the rest of the process kind of helps facilitate that to happen in respect to, like, once you get into the planning process, but you have an agreed way, you're going to, okay, no, we've set, this is the vision we want. So when things kind of fall outside that vision, it's quite quickly says, actually, no, that's not important. This is what's important for us. And once you get into that kind of discussion, the rest of the process kind of just helps fill that out to enable us to go after funding, enable us to best inform council about how we're going to improve those facilities, because and also inform when we're talking about a project over $1 million, they're often requiring planning approval as well. So if they require planning approval, then that means that we need that justification anyway. So the whole process, sometimes is seen as overburdening for volunteers and groups, and I can understand that. But the process is necessary because we need to respond to planning processes, we need to seek funding, and we need to be best informed in the way that we want to develop our facilities that is going to meet community needs, not just for now, but into 50 years' time.
Yep.
Because this is really, often when we're talking about these big ticket items, this is the one bite of the cherry. So you got to make sure you do it right. That's the kind of, that's my advice is, if groups can, the first step is the groups need to engage with the other users at a reserve. You're going to compete with different resources at that reserve and understand that. But what's absolutely important is that they respect each other's issues, objectives, and aspirations, they can come together and have some kind of form of an agreement of how they'd like to see the reserve improve in the future to meet everyone's needs, not just their sole objective.
So in the Olinda case, Ben, we're talking with Ben Bainbridge, the Executive Officer of Recreation at Yarra Rangers, in the Olinda example, and it's gone over 5, 6, 7 years, start to finish, were the people that started the process in the Recreation Reserve Committee, the ones that originally approached council, were they the ones that finished the process, or was there a turnover of people in that over the journey, and how did, I guess in one regards, once the process starts, almost council needs to help manage people in and out of the different parts, in the different roles, or was there just a couple of key people that just saw the process through start to finish?
Often, once this becomes people's passion. Once they get involved in it. So that we're not seeing a whole lot of turnover, to be honest. But like, we do have turnover in committee, often it's the president that might start the process, but they often continue on as a, you know, responsible for the project. So there's that continuous kind of contact.
Because this is kind of sitting above the club, isn't it? Like, it's sitting, you know, at a recreation reserve type committee level more so than at an individual club level.
Yeah, look, but understand, once you get into these projects, you're forming reference groups. Or control groups, and which there are nominated representatives. We often have more in our ranges. For our example, with the Olinda, we often have more than one representative of the groups. In the Olinda case, there's 3 or 4 people with particular specialist expertise that has really helped us in the design process.
Yes.
So the Hilltop Association themselves have recognised that, you know, the president of the club can provide a viewpoint on the project, but actually there are particular specialists in the club that will better support the outcomes of this project. Mm. And that's both in engaging with the membership. There are always countless conversations with the canteen staff around kitchen design. It's such an important... That's one advice. If you're looking at a pavilion, make sure you have the people running the canteen and the kitchens have their say. Absolutely, because it needs to be. It's one of the most important revenue raisers for clubs, so it's important that we get those spaces right. But also there's going to be builders in the clubs that can provide particular advice that really, once you get into a conversation with councils, you know, building project management area, or an architect or a quantity surveyor, they deal with these people all the time. So if you do have that expertise in your club, it's good to find it out and seek their support in some capacity into the process.
Beautiful. Now, I want to ask a question that we get asked a lot, in that a group of clubs will, and now I'm well outside your ranges, I'm not talking about your council at all now, Ben, but more seeking your general advice for how we would answer this for clubs. A group of clubs or a community has decided that they want to develop their pavilion or their playing surface. They've gone to council and it... For whatever part of the planning process they get to, whether it's the start or partway through or the master planning or whatever stage, and then it doesn't really fit into the council priorities for the next 3, 4, 5 years, because council have got other sport and recreation priorities. Now, these clubs are coming to us and saying, right, what can we do? And they're all fire and brimstone, and the last thing we advocate is going out to open warfare with council. But as opposed to saying to the clubs, well, you just need to wait, what can clubs do to make themselves more higher up the priority of that particular council that they belong to?
Yeah, look, there's really one thing. It's money talks. That might sound simple, and it is in a way, but look, if these projects can only happen through a creative mix of funding,
yep.
they are too expensive for a council to solely fund, and councils they often put funding proposals into state Sport and Recreation Victoria, so a state government department's Community Facility Funding Program, which is probably our main one.
Yes.
But when you start talking about a pavilion, it might have a range of different functions that are more community-focused as well, and that's through Community Support Fund offers that. And if you're in the rural area, the Regional Development Funding Program are probably three programs that I would have a look at as a club. But so councils really require and have a bit of a, you know, generally have a policy around trying to seek external funding to supplement their funding contribution, which there's no doubt council is the main one. They're often coming to the party. In this instance, in Olinda, we're putting over $1 million into the facility, where state government through the Community Support Fund and Sport and Rec are putting, Sport and Rec Victoria funding program is putting in $350,000.
Yes.
And we've got a club contribution of upwards of $100,000. And we've also got the Bendigo Bank putting in $250,000. So that's really fantastic. That demonstrates that creative mix of funding. But what the club was able to do in this instance, and what my recommendation is to a club that maybe isn't up the priority list but might have done the planning, is that they focus their energy on what they can control, and that's what fundraising for their project. And talking to your local councillors, so they're aware of, you know, this is a project. They can be an advocate for you in the council chamber when they're talking about a capital expenditure program.
Yeah.
They review that annually, and they look at their priorities every year. But if a club comes to council with X amount of money to be able to provide a good sum of partnership money to the project, then council's more likely to view that project really positively to try and bring it to a head, because the great thing is you've gone through a process. The process identifies that as a priority project for that community. However, when we look at it municipal-wide, it's probably not at our highest list. But that doesn't mean that it's not an important community priority that we want to fund. Yeah. We absolutely do want to fund it, but we've got to make some choices. And often these choices aren't black and white. These choices are often about whether community is can raise a sum of money to supplement their partnership money funding amount to the project, which means that it's more realistic to achieve it.
Yeah, and it also shows that shows community support, doesn't it? Where the community's contributing their own money in more than just words.
Yeah, that's right. And my advice to any community club is to look on the sports community website and have a look at the range of different kind of fundraising and sponsorship activities that you can derive. We've had some really interesting activities. We had an event with Ian Moss and a few other choir boys and a few other headline acts out here to try and raise money for a sports club to be able to fund a lighting project, you know, and some other things that are within their master plan. So, that would be my starting point. There's a whole range of different areas, but I would be having a look at that fundraising and grants page on the sports community webpage, because I think that's a fantastic first resource for clubs to have a look at. Because when they get to that stage and when they feel like they're in a bit of a holding pattern, often that's where you get the tired volunteers. That's when they actually do throw in the towel, and we don't want to be in that position because they've done such a power of work already, and we actually want to make it happen. But the reality is we need to be quite clear on our expectations of council. They take 4 or 5 years to build these things.
Yep.
And clubs need to know that up front.
Yep.
You've got to be in the long haul for this.
Yep.
This isn't a simple process.
Yeah, that's a really important message. So Ben, we're running out of time. We could talk for another half hour or an hour on this topic because it's something that fascinates us and we get asked it all the time. But in summarising what you say, if I can be so bold, get your community together, get organised, get a shared vision for the facility. Go and talk to council quickly. Get a framework. Get a process. Work in conjunction with council. Go through the planning process. Get strong community support for what it is that you're looking to do, and then the other research will fall into place. And then work on the fundraising. And I guess our one thing with fundraising, when you're talking, and thank you for your kind words about the sports community fundraising page. But you're looking at fundraising that you can't possibly do with running a few sausage sizzles. So you've got to look bigger and broader than that traditional club chocolate drive fundraising type sausage sizzle mentality. Get some serious funds. If you don't get onto the priority list straight away, then start to bring in the councillors, talk to Sport and Rec, and start to get the community right behind your event, and keep working positively with council the only way through, because it's the only way that it can really occur.
Absolutely. Look, I think often when you get into this kind of process, it's often becomes a real positive process. Like it's never ends up being a real negative one, because we're actually working on something that's really good for the community. I think that's the last point. It was a fantastic summary, by the way. But the last point is just to keep that in mind, is that you're doing something for community. You're doing something for your own membership. And actually, that's the same objective that what council staff, it's what everyone's working towards. But it takes a really big effort from a lot of people within council and from community and beyond to actually make this happen. But when it happens, oh boy, it's fantastic. It's a great day. We have a great celebration, and that's a facility for the next 50 years.
Well, what a fantastic note to finish. Joe was just about to chop me off at the head, Ben, for going a couple of minutes over, but I think that was well worthwhile. Ben, thank you so much for your time. That was brilliant.
And thanks, Joe. Thanks, Steve.
No worries, mate. That was Ben Bainbridge, Executive Officer, Recreation at Yarra Rangers Council.
Dreaming of a place which is abundant with fresh fruits, herbs and vegetables, cheeses, seafood, bread, cakes and many other regional delicacies? Well, stop dreaming, as the Farmers Market in Mornington has all that and a whole lot more. Enjoy freshly made coffee and ready-to-eat food in an environment which the kids will love. Open every second Saturday of every month from 8:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. $2 per adult. Children are free. The Farmers Market Mornington, our station sponsor. Peninsula Skin Cancer Centre has two centrally located clinics in Mornington and now in Frankston. They not only have state-of-the-art facilities, but also a great team of specialists with great skill in surgical technique and non-invasive skin cancer treatment. See for yourself on their open day, 15th of March, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at their new centre, 375 Nepean Highway, Frankston. Inquiries call 5975 9544. The Peninsula Skin Cancer Centre's a station sponsor.
More and more people with a taste for quality are shopping at Eliza Meats. Kevin and his lean team pride themselves on the finest cuts. From juicy steaks and roasts to high-grade mince and sausages, and Eliza Meats are the gourmet specialists. Inquire about Eliza Meats Spit Hire. Phone 9787 4473 for a mouth-watering meal fit for a king. It's all at Eliza Meats. See our sponsor Kevin at Eliza Meats, 112B Mount Eliza Way, a station sponsor.
Are you a business owner looking to cut costs in your business? Tough, isn't it? Let Bartercard show you a different way to increase your sales, cash flow and business profits. Don't wait. Increase your cash flow today. Boost your business with Bartercard. To find out how Bartercard can increase cash flow to your business, call 1300-BARTER. That's 1300-BARTER.
This is Sally from Sweet Pea Cuisine. At Sweet Pea Cuisine, we specialise in sharing knowledge, passion and enjoyment around food. We run cooking classes for kids, teens and adults, present food events and cooking demonstrations, create recipes to highlight your product and style food for the camera. Join me every Tuesday morning on the breakfast program when I chat about all things food on the peninsula. To find out more, visit me at www.sweetpeacuisine.com.au and like my Facebook page, Sweet Pea Cuisine. Stay sweet with Sweet Pea Cuisine, a station sponsor.
You're listening to Sports Community Radio. If you've missed the show this week, then visit our website at www.sportscommunity.com.au and download the podcast from our website. And while you're there, check out all the latest in grants and fundraising tips from the number one grassroots sports website in the country, sportscommunity.com.au. Okay, this week's top nine is why local media coverage is so important for grassroots sports clubs. So it's a very important one, Steve.
Yeah, in our travels around the country, Joe, we hear a lot of clubs complain two things. They're never in the local media, and other clubs just down the road always are in the media, and it's really hard to get in the local media. So first of all, today's top nine is we're tackling. Yeah, it is hard to get into the media. It takes a lot of effort. Takes some time.
But it's not impossible.
It's certainly not impossible, but. But today, next week's top nine, we'll talk about how to get into local media. But today, what I wanted to do is talk about why it is so important that your club is actually in the media and seen to be in the news.
Okay, so for everyone out there, our top nine are basically nine tips that we give you guys every week on different topics relating to sports, running sports clubs at grassroots level. If you miss them, you can get them on our website at www.sportscommunity.com.au. All right, let's rip, Steve.
Rightio. Now, the number one reason why attracting local media coverage is so important to clubs, Joe, is regardless of what people say, regardless of how old they are, and regardless of anything else, people love to see themselves in the media. They love to see their photo in the paper. They love to see their name in the paper.
They love to see scores. Yeah, Joe, because that's always for the negative reason. But generally, we're talking about...
Very true.
And that makes people, it makes the people who are featured in the articles feel good about themselves, but it also makes their friends and family and the community that support them feel really good about themselves. And those that aren't in the paper, those teams and clubs that don't go to the effort to get in the paper, like, they don't understand what they're missing. That really good sense of community pride, Joe. It really is a community pride issue. And to see, you walk into club rooms around the country and you see photos of newspaper clippings on the walls and you see cutouts. It's so very important for creating pride within your club. So, pride within the individual. So no matter how old you are, no matter how young you are, no matter if you're male, you're female, what you do, you're president, you're a player, you're a gun, you're just a novice, we love it anyway. So that's the first point. Number two, it allows those people that follow your club that aren't directly linked to the club at that particular point in time to actually follow it, to understand what's going on, to see the scores, to see who's going really well, to see who's, you know, how are you going against the opposition. It allows people to follow your club. And that's really important to build, to maintain a connection between people that love your club but are not actively involved in your club today. Because Joe, they might want to be back involved next week or next year.
Absolutely true.
Number three, Joe, it allows clubs to communicate and promote itself to members of the community that have no links to the club. One of the things that we learned in the research that came out last year from the Sports Commission, and we were talking about it this week in the office, was there's 3.8 million Australians over the age of 14 and 1.1 million Australians under the age of 14, so 4.9 million, if my math serves me correct, nearly 23% of the Australian population want to be part of a sports club or really want to be a part of a sports club but aren't. And the major reason that the research done by the Australian Sports Commission showed, the major research why people weren't part of a sports club was they didn't know what clubs had to offer. They didn't know what clubs were there, what clubs had to offer, how they could join, what activities. I mean, that's really basic information. So being continually involved in the media is a fantastic way of linking into people that aren't part of your club at the moment but may want to be part of your club. And so very, very important. It also, and moving number four, is, believe it or not, Joe, there's a part of the community that get frustrated with sport. There's sport, for some parts of the community, they see sport as taking away from the arts or taking away from education or money into sport, taking away from arts and taking away from education and taking away from health. So there's parts of the community that don't rate the investment that many parts of the community put into sport. And so being able to continually share the good news stories about your club, both on and off the field, what you do in the community, what you do in the at the club, is really, really important. It's really important for community health and well-being. So a much broader issue than just the club, but it also helps us as a sports industry continue to get the funding that we need.
I think a case in point there is that if you do look at the program lists of many community radio stations around the country, you'll find that it is quite heavily predisposed to arts and discussion type programs. And now there's nothing wrong with that. People are passionate about
love the arts.
Yeah, people are passionate about what they want to do and project to the community and the kind of community that they want to grow out there. But what we're saying here is that there is space in these media organisations for all of us, and especially sporting organisations and sporting clubs and grassroots clubs. And hence, that's the reason why Steve and I are on radio as well, because we want to make sure we're promoting the grassroots sports marketplace and sector and grassroots sports clubs in general.
Yeah, absolutely, Joe. And if we look at our radio station, where we record our show and our podcast, all of Saturday pretty much until from 7 o'clock in the morning, we kick the dew off bright and early, Joe, till about 6 o'clock in the evening is all sports. So sometimes that we need to look after that space and continue to nurture it. Exactly right. Mm-hmm. Number five, and this is where it becomes really important for clubs. Clubs take the time to put the stories out in the media. This is what we do on the field, on the court, on the pool. This is what we're doing in the community. This is what we're doing, giving the stories, telling the stories. Storytelling is something that you particularly are very passionate about. But every now and then, Joe, clubs want something back. They want the community to come and join them at a game, at a competition. They want to come and join them as members. They want them to come and try the club. They may want ask the community to be a sponsor, to be a member, to buy a raffle ticket, to come to an event. Every now and then, the club needs the community to support it and ask for a support in various ways, or effectively a call to action. So if that call to action can be made as well as through the club infrastructure and the club newsletter and that sort of thing, if it can be made through the general media, then you can reach a much broader audience and more people can hear about it, and the club's more likely to be successful in the goals that they're trying to achieve. And just a good example of what's going on at the moment in the morning, in our local Mornington Football Club, they're a couple of weeks away from having a very, very large sportsman's night, a sportsman's afternoon. And great speakers, AFL coaches and SEN Mark Fine radio presenters. And they've used the local media to get that message out, to get it to a much broader community than just the community that follows their club. So fantastic way of helping reach an audience much broader than your club. And to keep going down that path, Joe, when your club really gets into fundraising mode, you want as many people to know about it. So whether it's a sausage sizzle, or whether it's carols by candlelight that your club's putting on at Christmas, or another major event, or a small event, or whatever it is, when the club's got something, chocolate drive, raffles, and they would like the community support, if you can get it into the media, then that's fantastic.
Let's talk about that for a second. And when you're talking to the folks about this getting into the media, we're not advocating going there, knocking down doors and those kind of things. What we're saying is, if you want to have a story about your club's Christmas carols, for example, in the local paper, then write the story. Write it yourself. Talk to the local paper, say, what format do you want it in? How many words? What's the greatest chance of us getting published? Let us know and do some research. Look at some of the stories that have been written in the past. Put it down on email and send it to the editor of your paper. And they are looking for content, so they will publish it. So this is not rocket science that we're talking about here. We're talking about gaining valuable traction in the community by utilising the networks of your local media assets, your community radio, community newspaper, and you can do it yourself.
Right, absolutely, Joe, and you've just stolen half my top nine for next week's in how to get your story into the local media. And I'll get to this.
I'm sure that you're going to flesh it out much better than what I did, mate.
No, this week is all about, it is an important distinction as I start to talk back into the microphone. Sorry, Joe. I guess what we're trying to do this week, Joe, is to convince clubs that the effort of doing the work that we're going to talk about
next week,
it's really worthwhile. There is so much more benefits to
hugely worthwhile. It is one of the most worthwhile pursuits that a club can undertake. And in terms of return on investment, this is huge. So make sure you're listening to Steve's top nine this week and be listening next week when he goes into how we actually go about doing these things.
Okay, number seven, Joe, is local clubs do so much within the community that's nothing to do with the sport. If there's someone in need, if there's community organisations in need, clubs are the first one to wrap around them. You know, this is front of the newspaper sort of stories. This is not just sports stories. So
if we can tell, we as a sports industry can get those stories into the front of the newspaper, it is so powerful and so positive. People start to look at sports clubs not just for the competitive side of it, but for the fantastic social interaction that happens and the fantastic social support. And they start to look at clubs going, wow, that's something I want to be a part of. Mm. You know, mm. and that's so important. But as you're continually telling people at every opportunity, unless we have the ability to tell the stories go untold. And so that's why it's really worthwhile. So number eight is, again, it's about storytelling. Within your club, from time to time, there's key milestones. It could be a premiership, it could be a championship, it could be a major trophy win,
passing of a legend.
It could be a passing of a legend. It could be someone playing 100 games, 200 games, 300 games, kicking 100 goals, winning 10 straight games. There's, you know, the sort of thing I'm talking about, Joe, is the black caviar, 26 or 25 wins in a row sort of story. You know, that really feel good story of the player. It could be the player that's come back from adversity, that's going to hit the ground for the first time, or the competition for the first time after whatever that issue is. These are fantastic feel-good stories that it's not actually that relevant that it's the sport base. We need to tell those stories and we need to hear those stories. And so it creates that fantastic goodwill between the community and the club if the club's telling those stories. And finally, number nine, the top ninth reason, or the ninth reason why it's so important for clubs to make the effort to be in the media, because when it becomes time to recruit, and it doesn't matter whether you're a senior club or a junior club, if there's a choice of two clubs in your community, everyone knows one club because they're always in the newspaper and they don't know anything about the other club. If they know that one club does really good things in the community and they have really good social events and they really respect their players, and you can see just by the stories that are coming out in the media about the culture of the club compared to the other club, who may be an absolute brilliant club, but you don't know anything about that club. So you go to what you know. So being in the media absolutely makes it so much easier, A, to fundraise, but it also makes it easier to recruit people to your club, because they already know something about your club, Joe, as opposed to the club that's never in the media. No one knows anything about the club, so you've got to start from scratch. But it's amazing how much you pick up just by flicking through the paper or listening to the radio or on your community radio television stations and your Channel 31s of the world and out in the country, your Primes and your Win TVs and that sort of thing. So this week's, Joe, in very quick summary, it is why it is so important to be part to spend the time and the resources to get into the media, whether it be local newspaper, local television, local radio. Next week we'll talk about how you get in, because it's actually, for some clubs, find it quite challenging, but as you were saying, Joe, there's lots of little tricks to the trade that make it a lot easier, and it explains why our local table tennis competition is in the paper, has half a page in the sports pages, when our mainstream sports can't seem to crack it. So we'll cover that next week, Joe. So for this week, please trust us. It's worth the effort to create the content, tell the stories in your local media.
Okay, my friend, we are coming to that time in the show once again where we hate to do it, but we have to, and that is to leave everyone. So from Joe Novella.
And me, Steve Pallas, thank you for making us part of your sports community.